We'll hear about the tunnel dug by two West Berliners to smuggle out friends and family. And we'll join two friends who were the first to cross the border in 1989. But let's begin by taking you back to Berlin in the immediate aftermath of World War II, when the city was in ruins and at the centre of a struggle for global power. But the people who lived there were more concerned with survival. Lucy Burns has been speaking to a woman who grew up in the ruined German capital.
Berlin was completely devastated, and people emerged from underground shelters and they looked like zombies. And I remember these ashen and grey faces, and they were starved and ill and in rags and haggard looking. It was a frightful picture.
Berliner Christine Buschluter was just 3 years old when the war ended, but her childhood wasn't all about destruction and ruins.
My earliest and nicest childhood memories are of a garden in bloom, because it was the month of May. Unfortunately, my parents' house had been bombed out completely. It had been ruined, but very kind friends provided them with a garden house on an allotment, more like a little garden shed. And we lived there for several months, and there were cherry trees and apple trees. So it was a huge contrast to the situation in the city of Berlin, in the centre of Berlin.
By the winter of 1945, Christine's parents had found a flat back in the city. But their problems weren't over. The winters which followed the end of the war were some of the coldest in living memory.
There was no heating material at all. We were not the only one making their way to the famous park in Berlin, the Tiergarten, which was lush with trees, but now the Berliners went there in desperation and cut down the trees. And those people who were still lucky to have a flat and a roof over their head, they burned their furniture, even their parquet floors. I remember those bedtimes when I wasn't offered a pyjama, but was dressed in layers, many layers of woolen things, everything warm, and finally a cap, a woolen cap, scratchy and not very nice, was put over my head to just get through the night somehow.
There was rarely enough food, forcing the Berliners to find some creative solutions.
My father had the idea of venturing further out from the centre of Berlin. There were lots of little rivers and lakes, and he was after crayfish. He made us reach over into the muddy depth and just with our hands explore the mud and hopefully find a crayfish. And we did. There were so many of these little black things, and we stuffed them into the backpack until it was full, and then we had to make our way back to Berlin, which was a very laborious thing. And the biggest problem and the biggest hurdle were the border guards. They confiscated most of the things because usually their rations were not very generous either. And so our crayfish were very welcome.
After the war, Germany had been divided into four zones, each controlled by one of the four Allied powers, Britain, France, America, and Russia. Berlin lay deep inside the Russian zone, but as it was the capital, it was also divided between the four powers. Berliners, famously proud of their independence and their sense of humour, began referring to themselves as the Islanders.
Der Insulaner verliert die Ruhe nicht. Der Insulaner liebt kein Getue nicht, weil ihm.
As a child, Christine instinctively learnt how to negotiate with the different occupiers.
And the British were usually very correct, and the French were so la-la, a bit distant, and the Americans were helpful, friendly, outgoing, but the Russians were mean and dangerous, and you had to be aware that they could just ruin your day.
Christine also banded together with other children to find an active role in Berlin's thriving black market.
And my father would have never set foot on this black market. He was hanging on to his principles, but at the same time we had to eat. And so I continued my search for scrap metal in the ruins of the bombed out houses. With our metal pliers we cut all the copper or lead we could find and somehow lugged it to the surface and then sold it.
Christine's parents died in 1958 and she moved away from Berlin. But she looks back on her post-war childhood with fondness.
I don't feel deprived at all. On the contrary, I think I feel somehow enriched. I still am a little bit proud of how we managed to survive. We also had fun. It was not a constant trauma which we lived in. We were not unhappy children.
Christine Buschlüter, speaking to Lucy Burns. I'm Claire Bowes, and you're listening to Witness the Berlin Wall from the BBC World Service. A few years after the war, in 1948, West Berlin was blockaded by Soviet troops. No food or supplies were allowed in. America and its European allies decided an airlift to feed the people of Berlin was the only answer. Tristana Moore reports.
The Soviet blockade of West Berlin left its 2 million residents desperate for supplies. America and its allies took to the skies to beat the blockade.
Now, one thing that impresses me very much is the way the pilots and the crew are going about their work. It seems to me they've got a real appreciation of the tremendous importance of this job, how vital it is to everybody. And the German workers too, they're doing splendidly. Of course, one would expect that. They know how very important it is.
The chief supplies are flour, meat and vegetables, milk, sugar, potatoes and meat gravy. While one aircraft is landing them, another is circling the airfield preparing to land, and yet another is a black speck, rapidly becoming bigger, against the grey sky over the pine trees. Pine trees, of course, in the Russian zone. They come roaring up to a group of hangars, doors are thrown open before the propellers stop, and when I was there today, a row of German civilian lorries, 80 yards long, was waiting to take the food into Berlin.
In 1948, I was 7 years old, and I was scared about the sounds of airplanes coming over our house. I remember the time in end of the war, Second World War, when these airplanes bombed Berlin.
Mercedes Wild lived with her mother and grandmother in the US sector in West Berlin, directly under the flight path of the Allied planes near Tempelhof Airport.
I was scared in the beginning because it was the same sound like 3 years ago, and the time in the shelter was so terrible. The houses in the district were destroyed, and also our house was bombed. When you have this remembrance, you are fearing about the noise in the sky there.
For a small child, post-war West Berlin still felt like a very insecure place.
I asked my mother and my grandmother what is now with Berlin, and they said to me, all is okay, they bring us food and coal and salt, because the Soviets blockade the streets to Berlin. Once I saw on my way to school white parachutes coming down from such an airplane. And even in the schoolyard, when I was in the classroom, I saw this dropping of parachutes, and we were allowed to go out. But I was not so quick enough that I could fetch one. And yes, I was very sorry about this thing.
Sorry, because the parachutes being dropped close to the airfield contained food and sometimes even luxuries like sweets and chocolate. And so Mercedes devised a plan. To her 7-year-old mind, it seemed entirely possible that a pilot flying over the city could easily pick out her house, her garden, identified by her mother's white chickens, and then accurately drop a parachute full of goodies onto it.
At home, I decided to write a letter. I wrote a letter to my chocolate uncle in Airfield Tempelhof. Dear chocolate pilot, we live near the airfield of Tempelhof, and our chicken thinks your airplanes are chicken hawks. So they become frightened when you fly over the land. So they run in shelter with no more eggs from them.
And what about the last line, I think, or the, that when you...
Please drop some candy here, and your little friend Mercedes.
Over 60 years later, Mercedes still lives in the same house in Berlin's Schöneberg district.
Yes, four chickens, four white chickens.
Oh yeah, those are your chickens. And is that you there talking to the chickens?
Chickens, yes. They stopped laying eggs, and I told them that they must have an egg because my mother would give them for dinner.
Uh-huh. During the Berlin airlift, American, British and Allied pilots flew more than 2 million tons of food, coal, medicine, fuel and other supplies into the city. Ferdinand Friedensberg was the acting mayor of West Berlin.
Generally, I can only say that the people in Berlin are very grateful to the Anglo-American help through the air. And I can say for myself that with 1 year I am always outside listening whether the planes are coming and going. Perhaps this gives you the best idea how we are feeling about the airlift.
At the height of the airlift, an Allied plane landed every minute. According to historian Wolfgang Huschke, it was one of the most extraordinary international operations in aviation history.
The Berlin airlift marks the first defeat of communism and the just beginning Cold War. I'm convinced that the Soviets, and especially Stalin, underestimated completely the technical capacity of the United States Air Force and the Royal Air Force.
It wasn't until November 1948 that Mercedes got an answer to her letter from a Lieutenant Halverson, an American pilot.
Once when I came home from school, my grandma gave me a letter, and inside of this letter there was a gum and candy, one candy. And this gum was a peppermint gum, and it was unknown to me. And I changed it on the black market. The candy was okay, but the most impression to me was this letter from my chocolate uncle. It was hope to survive. This Lieutenant Halverson wrote to me that he have not enough time to fly past our house, and he hopes that I will have fun with this letter. The letter was the best I received in all my life.
The Berlin airlift ended in 1949 after the Soviets realized that Allied forces were sending in so many supplies that the blockade proved to be unsuccessful. Wolfgang Huschke says it was a humiliation for the Soviet leader Stalin.
The Berlin blockade ended on May 12, 1949, but the airlift continued because the Western Allied were afraid that the Soviets could start the blockade once more. So the enough stockpiles of goods, necessary goods, had to be established in West Berlin. And when this was effected, then the airlift could end.
Mercedes' story was later made into a children's book, which has been published in America and Germany. Now children all over the world can find out about her mother's chickens and the enduring legacy of the Berlin airlift.
Tristana Moore. 14 years after the blockade ended, the Soviets came up with a new way to isolate West Berlin. A wall. At first, many Berliners couldn't believe that they would be permanently cut off from one another. But it was to stay in place for almost 30 years. From Berlin, Steve Evans tells the story of the building of the wall.
East Berliners were awakened early this morning by heavy army lorries roaring through the streets and by the sirens of police cars. This was their first indication of the fact that the East German authorities had decided to seal off West Berlin from East Berlin and from East Germany, which surrounds it.
I'm standing just in front of the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin, that great stone arch which is the very symbol of this city. In the early hours of that day, the work of sealing the borders began right here, initially with rolls of barbed wire, blocking this gate into the east. Water cannons and troop carriers rolled up. Soldiers from East Germany, the Soviet zone, stood in lines, blocking citizens, their own citizens, from crossing into the west. The city's transport system was sliced in two.
Road crossings into West Berlin are all controlled now, and the underground and overhead railways, which used to run on from East Berlin into West Berlin, now stop at the last station in the Soviet sector and turn back.
Eventually, underground stations in the east were bricked off at street level, and trains from the west through, or rather under, East Berlin continued through these ghost stations, haunted only by the shadows of East Berlin border guards on the otherwise deserted platforms. Let's talk to two people who remember that day. Wolf Kühnelt lived in East Berlin, but first Klaus Michael von Keusler, who was a student in the west, and who came to the border that morning, right here at the Brandenburg Gate.
People from the East German police, they started to lay down barbed wire, and we became aware that the East German government was going to close East Berlin. We were completely shocked, and we couldn't believe that this could be successful.
I was right in the east of Berlin when it was on the 13th of August, and we had just finished our school, and so we are really surprised by this message that they erect such a wall in Berlin, and Berlin is divided. When I grew up in Berlin, the border was just a white line on the floor, and you could go where you wanted to. So we went to cinemas and libraries and shops and all this.
The East Berlin authorities, they closed all doors of the houses using concrete, the windows as well as the doors, and later on they started also to demolish houses. People also tried to escape from these East Berlin houses.
Only a few minutes ago I returned from the main refugee reception center at Marienfeld. There are so many people in process of being cleared through the center that it's hard to arrive at accurate figures. Some of these made quite dramatic escapes. For example, a man, his wife and two children, swam the canal in the night. The husband supported their three-year-old child on his shoulders. An eight-year-old, a little girl, swam as best she could between her parents. Others cut newly strung barbed wire in the dark and made a dash for freedom at the less heavily guarded points.
And the second, third, fourth day, people tried to cross the barbed wire to escape. These escapees were always applauded. People tried by using ladders to let people escape. They assisted them, and as you may know, I myself also started very early to assist our student fellows from East Berlin to come to West Berlin.
How?
We forged passports, West German passports, brought the passports to East Berlin, tried to find somebody who, of course, was willing to escape and who looked similar to the passport photo which we brought over the wall.
This is Peter Woods calling Radio Newsreel from West Berlin. The flow of refugees was 2,300 a day until the Reds barricaded the frontier last Sunday. Now the flow has dwindled down to only a handful each night. One of the people who has managed to get across is a doctor from East Berlin. Doctor, how did you get across?
By obtaining an identification card from one of my West Berlin friends. He gave it to me, and since our faces do match a little bit except for the eye color, I thought I could make the run for freedom. I combed my hair his way, his fashion, plastered it down with some brow cream, and then I put my thumb over the eye color, which was written down as steel blue, and mine are actually dark brown. So I went up one of these transport police guards and asked him, well, can I go to West Berlin? And he asked me, well, are you West Berliner? He said, yes, I am. So I showed him the identification card. He asked me, are you really West Berlin? I said, yes, I am. And he let me pass.
People built small constructions, or they took a table or a chair, and then they waved. And then they made appointments at what time Should we see each other? Or they give signals by lights from one house to another. They throw parcels over the wall, which was ridiculous because there were guards on the eastern side.
The view from Klaus Michael von Keusler in the west. Wolf Kühnert's view from the east was different, though they did know there what was going on.
It was the same TV, the same broadcast station you could receive every evening. I am sure most of the people in East Germany, they didn't see the wall at all. They just saw it in the TV from West Berlin.
But then there were a few people who found themselves divided. Yeah. Is that, you can see it here. That side of the street was in the west, and you can tell by the architecture.
Right.
And that side over there was in the east, was East Berlin.
Yeah,
and people were divided.
I remember it very well, because I had, in that time, a girlfriend just living over there on the other side. And, you know, in the morning you could see, just by binocular, you could read the headlines of newspapers in the west.
What, you would look over the wall with binoculars and read the papers?
Yeah. Sometimes, when you were visiting somebody in that area, so you could see the wall and you could see the newspapers from the other side. Just one door in the neighborhood, they built a tunnel. There was a sort of a tunnel, and some people, they just went through 10 or 15 meters from where I was.
The first difficulty was to find a house very close to the wall, and of course in this house a cellar from where we could start digging our tunnel. We ourselves, we never ask for money, but later on, one has to be honest, there were also groups, let's say in the late 60s, which asked money for letting people escape from east to west.
Overnight, the Russians moved more than 30 tanks into East Berlin. The British moved extra men and weapons down to the Brandenburg Gate as a precaution. Then, in late afternoon, the Americans laid on a modest probe into East Berlin, again to assert their right of free access. As their tanks withdrew, the Russians came up. The United States tanks reappeared, so later did the Russians.
Our feeling was that we trusted our allies, the Americans, the British and the French, and we thought these guys would immediately ask their tanks to remove these barbed wire fence and later on the concrete blocks.
As we now know, American and British tanks did not remove the barbed wire and the wall. It remained as the great focus of tension in the Cold War.
Steve Evans reporting. After the break, we'll hear from two men who launched the most successful escape from East Germany by tunnel. That's when Witness the Berlin Wall continues from the BBC World Service.
Grab your ukulele and head for the shore.
I'm Robin Young. The ukulele has been strummed by everyone from Elvis to Will.i.am. It even has its own festival in Florida. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
I'm Claire Bowes, and this is Witness the Berlin Wall, from the BBC World Service. October 1964 saw one of the most successful escapes from East Germany via a tunnel under the Berlin Wall. Luis Hidalgo talks to two of the men who helped build what became known as Tunnel 57.
This is David Smeaton, 200 feet above the Berlin Wall, a vantage point that reveals the full extent of the 100-mile barrier that surrounds nearly 2 million people in West Berlin. 20 miles of wall splits the city clean in half. A 200-yard-wide scar of raked earth, guarded by electrified fences, ditches, dogs, guard towers, and the 9-foot-high wall itself.
The wall dominated the city.
Wherever you were going in West Berlin, after a certain short time, you came to the wall. Whether it was to the north or to the west or to the east or to the south, West Berlin was walled in or fenced in.
Ralph Kabisch had moved to West Berlin shortly after the wall went up, and it was there that he met a man who is still his friend today, Achim Neumann. Achim had used a fake passport to escape from East Germany. His girlfriend had stayed behind, but she now wanted to try and join him. In the early days, it was still possible to escape by cutting the wire. Some people even jumped out of the windows of houses which overlooked the border.
A man, his wife and two children, swam the canal in the night. The husband supported their three-year-old child on his shoulders. Others cut newly strung barbed wire in the dark and made a dash for freedom at the less heavily guarded points.
But the East German secret police, the Stasi, soon made it more difficult. And so activists, many of them students, came up with a new idea to tunnel under the wall to get friends and relatives out. There were a number of attempts. The first tunnel that Achim helped build got flooded. The second one, someone tipped off the Stasi.
So the Stasi awaited us in the cellar in East Berlin, and we were very happy to escape. But nobody came through this tunnel, and several refugees were arrested.
Achim's girlfriend, Christa, was among them. Achim then heard of a new plan, this time to build a tunnel from an old boarded-up bakery on Bernauerstrasse. Bernauer Street was effectively the border. The houses on one side were in the east and the other the west. The same group of students had built a tunnel there before. Three people had escaped through it before it was discovered by the Stasi, which made it the perfect place to try again. Ralph Kabisch takes up the story.
The East German Secret Service simply did not think that we would do it from the same location. And so we did. First, there was a shaft about 11, 12 meters deep, driven down until we came to the groundwater table. And from there, in the depth of about 12 meters plus minus, we started then to dig the tunnel into east.
Work began in April 1964. And it was painstakingly slow.
We worked around the clock in two shifts, 12 hours. We were approximately 20 to 25 students. And the cross-section of the tunnel was very small. It was 80 to 90 centimeters. So it was not possible to walk, just to crawl. And the digging itself was mostly with a spade. We were lying on the backside, and with the feet, we put the spade into the soil. It was kind of clay, so it was very, very hard to dig 1 meter per shift.
And when you went on shift, did you stay in this building the entire time, or would you go home, sleep, get some food, then come back for the next shift?
No, we lived in the cellar for 2 or 3 weeks. It would be too dangerous when young men every day or every night come in or leave this house. And so we have decided to stay there, and we lived in this cellar. So it was a hard time, of course.
It took 5 months. But eventually, in October 1964, the breakthrough came.
The one who was digging came back with a little bit of a plant, some grass with some roots. It was a very tiny thing. But he said, hey, it appears that we are at or at least very close to surface.
In those days, people with West German passports could cross into East Berlin on a one-day visa. So one of the students was sent across to see if, after 145 meters of digging, the tunnel was coming up in the right place.
He, of course, went from house to house and was listening. And finally, he came to the backyard of that house where our tunnel ended. And he heard that we were digging or talking. At least he heard some noise from us.
They'd meant to end up in the cellar of number 55, Strelitzer Street. They'd actually come out a few meters early in a disused outside toilet in the backyard. It would do. Messages were sent out to the East Germans waiting to cross. Come to 55 Strelitzer Strasse the following evening.
You go up towards the wall at the house number 55. You knock at the door and you whisper a code word, Tokyo.
Ralph was hoping his cousin, who lived in the East, would get the message and come. But Achim didn't even know whether Christa was still in jail. Then, the very day that the escape was due to take place, Achim got a letter.
And she wrote me that she is out of prison 5 months before expected. But now I had to find somebody to contact her.
Akeem tried to send someone to get a message to Krista, but would they get it to her in time? Meanwhile, he made his way through the tunnel. His job was to stand at the exit of the tunnel in the East German courtyard and help the refugees in.
That was, of course, the most dangerous moment of my life, I think. And we were four students. And so we waited for the refugees, and I think 8 o'clock in the evening or so, the first refugees came.
Each refugee had been given a time to arrive, and Akeem knew that if Krista had got the message, she would come at 10:30.
But I had no watch, and so I had no idea how late it was. And suddenly, one of my friends came from the house with a young girl on his arm and told me, "Be careful, she is very nervous." So we recognized each other. Just in this moment when we stood very close together on the dark yard in East Berlin.
Gently, Akeem lowered Krista into the tunnel. She begged him to come with her, but he couldn't. There were more refugees to help. That first night, 28 East Germans escaped through the tunnel. Ralph, meanwhile, was waiting for them on the West German side.
When I saw them then coming, and you looked in their faces, in their eyes. You know, these are moments you'd never forget for the rest of your life.
The escapees were taken to safe houses, and the next night the tunnel was opened again. This time, 29 people made it through. Before, around midnight, the Stasi discovered the house. There was a shootout, and one East German border guard was killed. The four students, Akeem amongst them, managed to get back through the tunnel by the skin of their teeth.
These four, they broke any record, virtually running on their knees, on their elbows through the tunnel and coming to daylight, to the bakery. Then by 2 or 3 in the morning, everybody went home. I remember that coming home, I was really crying and fell into my bed like a stone.
Ralph's cousin was not among the 57 people who escaped during those 2 nights in October. She hadn't been there when the message came. Akeem and Krista were married a few months later.
Louise Hidalgo. I'm Claire Bowes and you're listening to Witness the Berlin Wall from the BBC World Service. Before the wall fell 25 years ago, there was Leipzig. Massive demonstrations in the East German city triggered the collapse of the country's communist government just a month later. Lucy Burns has been speaking to one of the protesters.
The demonstration began in the narrow cobble streets in the centre of the city, where people seemed unworried by the menacing presence of large numbers of plainclothes security men.
The BBC's Brian Hanrahan was there.
They went on chanting their slogans for political reform until they were joined by several thousand more who'd been attending church services. And then, in a confusion of packed bodies, they started to march.
The demonstrations had been growing for some time, which in East Germany was a new phenomenon. Singer-songwriter and poet Martin Jankowski.
The GDR at that time was a socialist dictatorship. They called themselves the dictatorship of the proletariat. This meant for everybody to have very restricted life, from kindergarten until you die.
Even though Martin was still a teenager, he had already suffered personally from the repressive regime.
When I was a student at high school, I started being observed by the Stasi, the Socialist Secret Service of the GDR. Because of my oppositional writings of poems and songs and so on. So when I finished high school and wanted to go to the university, I wasn't allowed. I didn't get a job and I couldn't work. At all. Since 87, I started being a member of a circle of oppositional dissidents around the Protestant main cathedral in the center of Leipzig, St. Nikolai Church.
The Protestant Church traditionally harbors what modest public dissent the rulers of this blinkered land have been willing to tolerate.
In the beginning of the 80s, at this cathedral, St. Nikolai in Leipzig, they started something that we called Friedensgebete, peace prayers. And this was once a week, and it was a kind of political prayer against nuclear weapons, against this logic of the Cold War, Firstly, it was just a small event, maybe 20 or 30 people joining this group every week. But the peace prayers in Leipzig became something like a gathering point for the oppositional movement of the whole country.
And the peace prayers grew as discontent among East Germans began to bubble to the surface.
In the beginning of 89, more than 4,000 people usually came to the weekly peace prayer in Leipzig. This was more than the church could bear, so people started gather outside the church, which already looked a little bit like a demonstration. So this was the time when the police started being aware that something is going on.
The 7th of October 1989 was East Germany's Republic Day, but it went badly for the regime, with violent demonstrations and arrests.
They chanted pigs at the police, and in scenes repeated in cities across East Germany, hundreds were beaten and 700 were arrested in Berlin alone, thrown into the back of lorries.
So the whole country was in attention, and everybody was looking to Leipzig now, because everybody knew Leipzig is the meeting point of the oppositional movement in this country. The peace prayer, Monday, 5 p.m. at Nikolai Church in Leipzig.
For the East German government, the fact that the protests were spreading represented a serious threat, and so they sent thousands of troops and police to Leipzig. It was only a few months since their Chinese comrades had successfully repressed their own rebellion in Tiananmen Square by shooting and arresting demonstrators, and politicians began talking about a Chinese solution to the East German demonstrations.
The state institutions started building a big threat against everybody. For instance, in the newspapers, they wrote articles, whoever will be on the streets on Monday again is in danger of life, because we will defend the socialism with weapon. The hospitals of Leipzig were preparing for emergency situations with shooting wounded people, and even they got delivered body bags.
And in the context of the Cold War, what happened in Leipzig had implications outside East Germany too.
Everybody was in fear of a civil war, and nobody could imagine what follows then. Will the Russian interfere? Is this the beginning of a new war between East and West? Because we thought if there would be a civil war in Leipzig, maybe the West had to react.
And so on the 9th of October, Martin and his fellow Christian activists were worried.
When I went to church on that afternoon, it was around 3 o'clock, to do the preparations for the peace prayer, I could see that already thousands and ten thousands of people filled the whole center of Leipzig. I could see also families with little children, with grandmothers, old people and so on. And I really asked myself, what will happen to them if we really will have a violent conflict that day?
At 5 o'clock, the service started.
The church was packed with people, but the funny situation was that the church was occupied by around 2,000 propagandists of the Socialist Party. They were sent by their leaders to occupy the church already in the afternoon, which in a way was a crazy idea, because now other people couldn't get a place inside the church, so they stood outside, which created this kind of demonstration situation that the party wanted to avoid. And the other thing was, the most of the members of socialist parties didn't know how to behave in a church, because they never have been in a church before. So they were very nervous and insecure about the situation. We talked to them, we made jokes to them. I started singing songs with them, so we gave them the text so they could sing along. And they really tried to do their best to create a peaceful atmosphere. And when the doors opened at the end of this peace prayer, maybe it was around 6 o'clock, we couldn't go out. Why? Because the city was so crowded, everybody was waiting outside, that there was no space for the people to go out. The whole center of the city was so crowded that there was not even a procession of demonstrators, because the whole main highway around the city center was packed with people. So they just stood around, and it was not even really possible to walk.
Now came the moment. How would the police react? But there was confusion in the chain of command.
Nobody in this situation wanted to give the order to shoot. Why? There's only one answer, because we were too many in the streets. They were prepared to arrest maybe 3,000 or 4,000 people, but in the streets were between 70 and 120,000 people on that day. With their children, with grandmother and everything, stood in the streets and said, okay, troops, if necessary, shoot us, but your name is People's Army, your name is People's Police, and we are the people. It was really a party atmosphere. I have seen people sitting on the roof of a police car having a cigarette together with the policeman and giving light to each other.
Later that night, Martin and his friends met back at his flat.
We were so happy. We wanted to open a bottle of champagne. Unfortunately, in socialist economy, you couldn't buy a bottle of champagne, not at midnight. So we just had a cup of tea together with the happy idea of have seen a day together that would change the history of our country.
After the 9th of October, change came rapidly to East Germany.
1 month later, the wall came down. A few months later, we had the very first free elections in East Germany. Nearly exactly 1 year later, we had the reunification of Germany. Was a consequent out of that moment, the moment when the decision was made, this conflict will end peacefully.
That report by Lucy Burns. Two friends filmed some of those protests in Leipzig. Weeks later, on the 9th of November 1989, they found themselves back in East Berlin on the cusp of history. Michaela Gratian has been talking with these two friends, Aram Radomski and Siegbert Schäfke, or Ziggy, who believe they were the first to cross from East to West Berlin that night.
Wir saßen in einem Lokal, in einer Kneipe, und hatten das Radio.
We were sitting in a bar and we heard Günter Schabowski on the radio. And what we heard was part of a big press conference. All we heard were the words, East German citizens are allowed to travel immediately.
Günter Schabowski was a senior communist politician. He'd been giving a press conference when suddenly he surprised everyone.
Und deshalb haben wir uns dazu entschlossen.
Therefore, we have decided to introduce new regulations today, which allow every citizen to travel out of East Germany by way of the border crossing points.
When does it come into force?
As far as I'm aware, that's immediately, straight away.
Immediately, straight away. Those words were totally off the cuff. The new rules allowing freedom to travel were supposed to take effect later, not immediately. Schabowski now says he hadn't been told. He'd been caught on the hop and it was a live press conference. A lot of people heard it.
Und haben uns beide angeguckt und hatten eine Idee.
So we looked at each other and we had an idea. We'll go and have a look, and if we're not back in 2 hours, then come and meet us at midnight at the Cuckoo's Egg. We knew someone who had a bar in West Berlin in Kreuzberg called the Cuckoo's Egg, and everyone just laughed at me.
The two friends left the bar and went to Ziggy's house.
Lass mich Festgeld holen, damit wir da drüben nicht irgendwie.
So I got 50 Deutschmarks for each of us, and I put it in my underpants, because we weren't allowed to have West German money. We went in my Trabant car with the money stuffed into my underpants, and then I parked the car and we walked to the crossing.
Built in 1961, the Berlin Wall split the city, and for East Germans, travel was severely restricted. Border crossings were places of barriers, fences and border guards. Until that night, their orders had been to stop anyone from crossing.
Wir kamen da zu diesem Grenzübergang, also.
We went up to the checkpoint, closer than I'd ever been, and there was only about 25 or 30 people, and they were asking, what's going on? The border police didn't know what to do. I walked up to one of the border guards with Aram, and we said, well, actually it was more Aram than me. He went up and he said, we're allowed to travel immediately. We heard it on the radio. Immediately means now, at once. I think Aram and I said it 20 or 25 times. We repeated it over and over. It felt a bit uncomfortable, actually, that we kept saying it. And this border guard, he was getting quite annoyed. We were provoking them.
Wir haben es einfach provoziert. Und dann sagte Aram, glaube ich,
Aram told the border guard, why don't you let the 20 or so people here cross? Look behind me. They're already collecting stones. Soon there'll be trouble. Well, I was surprised Aram dared to say that. I hadn't really seen this, but it had an effect on the border guard.
So, Aram, did you tell a little lie about the stones to try to get what you wanted?
Natürlich.
Yes, of course. We were feeling pretty confident. We didn't have the sort of fear you might imagine. With Ziggy, I had experienced some pretty extreme situations, and we were tough.
In one of the extreme situations Aram talks about, the friends had secretly filmed a mass demonstration in Leipzig. In that demo, just a month earlier, the much-feared East German police had allowed 70,000 people to march. There'd been no crackdown. Ziggy and Aram sent their footage to a journalist in the West and the word got out. If the authorities had loosened up in Leipzig, maybe the same could happen in Berlin. The thought was driving the friends on.
Ja, das war ganz, ganz komisch.
It was very strange. In the background, we could see these guys in uniform on the telephone, talking, walking back and forth, up and down. We could see them through the window. And at some stage, maybe it was about 20 minutes later, a border guard walked up with a box of rubber stamps and he said something like, "Right, here we go." We passed him our identity cards and he stamped them.
And that's why I said, "Well then, open the door here." And so a little door was opened, like a gate. And so we were the first people through it.
Wir waren die Ersten. Und wir waren auch die Ersten.
We were the first to cross. We really were the first. And I only really believe we were in the West when we were sitting in a Mercedes taxi. We're in the West, I thought. We've done it.
In the taxi, Ziggy showed the driver his Deutschmarks to prove he could pay. And then they were off to a friend's place in a part of West Berlin called Schöneberg.
We
came from an extremely shabby world. East Berlin was an architectural catastrophe. The buildings had been neglected since the 50s. And then suddenly, we were standing in a bourgeois flat in the West. It seemed so new, so luxurious. I think the carpet was a deep burgundy color. It was like something from a film.
We
were led into a big room. One of Ziggy's friends went room to room, waking people up. And slowly they started coming in. "Who is there?" they asked. "Ziggy? Aram? How did you get here? Did you come via Hungary?" "No," we said. "We came straight from East Berlin." "But how?" they asked. "You should turn on the radio," I said. "I think they've opened a wall."
The police commander on duty here at Checkpoint Charlie has suddenly announced that they can go over. They're simply charging now through the small gate in the fence.
Unknown to Ziggy and Aram, tens of thousands of people had followed them. What began as a trickle had turned into a flood.
We had ja noch eine Verabredung und wir wollten es ja auch unseren Freunden.
We had an appointment to make and we wanted to see our friends from the east, the ones we left in the bar. We told them, "Let's meet in the Cuckoo's Egg at midnight," and we wanted to go. On the way, we went quite close to the wall and suddenly came across this incredible joy.
She's crying. Yeah, I mean, this is it. This is history.
What do you think about this evening?
I think it is a very, very important day.
Fantastic.
Wonderful. That's great. It's wonderful.
Standing on top of the Berlin Wall, and there can be few better illustrations of the changes which are sweeping across the...
Tausenden Menschen, die in dieser Nacht sich noch aufmachten.
Thousands of people knocking on the bonnets of the little Trabant cars. This unbelievable joy. Unbelievable joy. I can still see it now. These people who didn't know each other at this artificial, deadly construction. They were drinking sparkling wine and hugging each other and dancing. We did that as well, but after a while we got a bit tired of that and we went to the Cuckoo's Egg. And you know what? All eight of our friends were there. All eight friends who we'd left in East Berlin just a few hours earlier. And I had to say, I had this feeling of satisfaction. I said, "See, guys, I was right, wasn't I? Aram and Ziggy were right, after all."
Aram und Ziggy haben manchmal doch immer wieder recht.
After celebrating at the Cuckoo's Egg, Aram Radomski went home to East Berlin early the next morning. He still lives in the eastern part of the city. Ziggy Schaefker partied for 5 days before finally going home for a change of clothes. Today, he also lives in the former east of Germany, in Leipzig. They were speaking with Michaela Gratian. And I'm Claire Bowes. That brings us to the end of this look back at the history of the Berlin Wall. To hear more of our witness programmes, go to bbc.co.uk/witness.
Ashmead's Kernel.
Ida Red.
Wine Sap.
Snapdragons and Ruby Frost.
Ever heard of them apples? I'm Ira Flatow. On the next Science Friday, we look at the science of apples, taking us beyond Red Delicious. Plus, why you may be getting a bad deal on high-speed internet compared to web surfers in Chattanooga or Kansas City. All on Science Friday from PRI.
Friday afternoon at 1 on AM 580.
I'm Marco Werman. Next time on The World, the latest news and this story about abortion clinics in Maine and about some new patients who are driving a long way to get there.
We only do abortions once a week, but at our last clinic, half of the clients were from New Brunswick.
Why Canadian women are terminating their pregnancies in Maine. That story on The World.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
WILL programming is made possible by The Chorale, opening its 33rd season with a Celebration of Life concert November 8th at 7 p.m. at Faith United Methodist Church in Champaign. The Chorale will honor veterans with patriotic melodies. Dr. Michael Hammer accompanies founding director Julie Biley.